Welcome to the Syrian Civil War podcast. I'm your host, Chris Gentry. This podcast provides a detailed understanding of the Syrian Civil War and the conflict around it. Welcome to the Syrian Civil War. Welcome to the Syrian Civil War podcast. I'm your host, Chris Gentry. In today's episode, we will look into Raqqa, the Deir ez-Zor conflict, the Syrian chemical attack on Khan Shaykhun, and the status of Iraq. Then we'll host a special talk on Iran's involvement with Syria with Dr. Gadarzi. First, to Raqqa. On October 14th, the remaining IS units that were holding out in the sports stadium as well as the hospital negotiated an agreement with the SDF and left. In the remaining 3 days, the SDF pushed in to recapture the remainder of the city, and on October 17th, they captured the last district. International reactions from the West were praise of the SDF forces. Though the official position of Russia and Syria is that all the US did was destroy the city, making it uninhabitable. Here is a clip from Russian media discussing the recapture.
By a local journalist, which have given a rare look inside the city, revealing the true scale of its destruction.
First of all, let me say that what is happening now in Raqqa is destruction. It's not liberation at all. For 84 days, Raqqa has been under siege. But this siege only harms civilians trapped inside since ISIL captured the city. And the siege is imposed by Syrian democratic forces on the ground and is backed by the US-led coalition's airstrikes. These airstrikes destroy schools, hospitals, the whole infrastructure. We as journalists have documented that more than 2,000 civilians have been killed as a result of the coalition's airstrikes. They do not target the places where jihadists gather, although everyone knows where they are. While US jets attack from the air, SDF attacks from the ground. And at night, jihadists use suicide vehicles to regain territories controlled by the SDF. But there is no serious combat at all. One can see that clearly from the videos posted by both the SDF and the coalition. Look, ISIL has about 1,000 fighters in Raqqa. And the SDF claims to have 35,000 to 40,000 soldiers. And they confront a mere 1,000 terrorists? If SDF and the coalition wanted to liberate Raqqa, they could accomplish it within 10 days. Safe passage?
Here is a clip from Western media.
It is looking like we are at a major turning point in a story that we and the whole world has been watching for the past 3 years plus now. We're talking about the Syrian city of Raqqa, the capital of the caliphate of the so-called Islamic State or ISIS, that having fallen to the combined forces of Kurdish and Arabic fighters. This, according to those forces, a U.S. official telling Fox News just a few minutes ago, a little bit more circumspect, 90% of the city has been recaptured. The U.S., of course, backing this effort in a big way, especially with its air power. An intense battle has gone on in the city for the past 4 months. Some ISIS fighters have fled, some have surrendered, many have been killed, the last few hundred apparently holding out against the forces. Raqqa, hugely important, symbolic to the terror group. It was its headquarters. It is where the foreign fighters coming from outside would be processed and dispatched, where foreign prisoners, Americans, hostages would be put on display, tortured, killed, where attacks against the U.S., Europe, the whole world were plotted.
See the difference? It is true that a large portion of the city was destroyed in the house-to-house fighting that took place during the campaign. As civilians had begun to return to the city, civilians continue to die. The cause of death is UXOs, unexploded ordnances. It is estimated that nearly 120 people have been killed as a result of mines in recent weeks. Islamic State does and will continue to leave booby traps around, and this time should be no different. In recent Raqqa news, the BBC broke a story on the 12th of a deal between the US-backed Kurdish and Arab SDF and ISIS. The initial deal was that a small amount of unarmed fighters would be allowed to leave the city. That's what we were told. However, the BBC uncovered that instead, the deal allowed nearly 4,000 IS fighters and their families to leave the city. These fighters were not just leaving the city, they were also leaving with weapons, ammunition, and explosives. This was an attempt by the West as well as the Kurdish forces to end the campaign. The coalition did not want to leave pockets of resistance that would kick up from time to time. However, those fighters, many of whom are foreign jihadis, are now loose in the world. Some have reportedly been caught trying to cross the border into Turkey. This is a pretty serious situation. We were pretty blatantly lied to, not only by the SDF, by the people that are on the ground. The truck drivers who transported the foreign fighters talked about being threatened with explosives and threatened with murder afterward. It's a pretty fucked up situation all around. Now, on to Iraq. On November the 3rd, Iraqi forces entered Al-Qaim, which is the last major town in Iraq controlled by IS. The city was backed by a combination of Sunni tribal militias, PMFs, and the Iraqi counterterrorism forces. Iraq then pushed towards the border and hours later recaptured the border crossing with Syria. The coalition estimates that nearly 1,500 Islamic State fighters were estimated to remain in the immediate vicinity of the town. Islamic State has captured the town in August of 2014. There were rumors that Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi had only recently passed through the town in early November. The only town that remains in the hands of IS at all in Iraq is the city of Rawa and the surrounding desert. As of today, the Iraqi army has begun an operation to liberate the city as part of a broader Western Iraq campaign. In a further round of IS losses, IS has also begun to lose Deir ez-Zor.
On Friday, the Syrian army announced that it regained full control over the city of Deir ez-Zor. The latest advances came after the army managed back in September to break an ISIL militant siege on the city that lasted for 3 years. Since then, the army, backed by air support from the Russian Air Force, has been advancing steadily in the province of Deir ez-Zor, the main province of eastern Syria that stretches along the borders with Iraq and is considered the country's richest in terms of natural gas and oil fields. A field commander in Deir ez-Zor said that Syrian troops managed to break the last defense lines north of the city before dawn on Friday. The officer who spoke with CGTN said that his soldiers are still combing the city in search of any remaining ISIL militants, adding that the last defenders fled the city at night, heading towards the eastern bank of the Euphrates, where ISIL still controls a handful of villages there. Many believe that the next goal of the military operation will be towards the city of Al-Bukamal, the crossing point with Iraq that is the last stronghold of ISIL in eastern Syria. Ala Ibrahim, CGTN, Damascus.
And is on the verge of losing the Deir ez-Zor pocket as a whole. The siege on Deir ez-Zor was broken in early September. The SDF has also had an operation to recapture the area around to the north of Deir ez-Zor. This operation began in August and over the last 2 months has recaptured nearly 3,500 square kilometers of territory, importantly containing all of the pockets east of the Euphrates. The Syrian army campaign led by the Tigrayan 4th Division forces has begun to close the pocket to the south of the Euphrates. The forces on November the 3rd claimed victory as they recaptured the edges of the city as well as the city center, though a few IS islands remain, mostly around the Hawajat Kati area, and I think we expect those to fall any day now. Deir ez-Zor, like Aleppo, was a conflict that caught the international attention, similar to the Libyan rebels fighting in Misrata under siege and continually struggling to survive. It is a testament to all those who fought to free Deir ez-Zor of the success of the operation. I think it's worth mentioning the name of Issam Zadarin, who led the Syrian Arab Army's resistance. He became famous for traveling to the front lines and interacting with ordinary soldiers. Whether or not you agree with the side he fought for, he remains an important figure, and he was killed earlier this year in October by a landmine. With that, we move to the Syrian chemical attack. Earlier this season, we discussed this chemical attack on Khan Shakun that killed over 90 people. At the time, while it seemed very likely the attack was propagated by the Syrian government, we did not have enough evidence to say decisively. However, in the end of October, the United Nations expert and a chemical watchdog announced the government was responsible for the sarin attack that killed over 90 people. The report said, quote, "Leadership panel is confident that the Syrian Arab Republic is responsible for the release of sarin at Khan Shakun. The UN inspector has found sufficient evidence the Syrian aircraft dropped the munition and the munition was sarin." Two North Korean shipments have also been intercepted in the last 6 months to the Syrian government's chemical weapons agency. In response to this, the Russian government attacked the inspectors for the claims that the Syrian government was responsible for the attack, something that Russia still, even after the report, strongly denies. Now, an update on the Iraq crisis. After the Iraqi government seized control of the city of Kirkuk, as well as the remaining disputed territories, the Iraqi government took control of Kirkuk, Sinjar, Dakuk, as well as others after the situation that resulted after the Kurdish referendum crisis. This importantly includes the oil fields and airports of those areas. The Iraqi central government has used this as a move to consolidate the KRG under the central government, beginning a move to pay the Peshmerga and kind of wind them into the Iraqi military. Currently, the Kurdish and Iraqi central government are at a standoff. The KRG right now is being threatened with possible military action unless they hand over their share of oil revenues. As of now, Kurdish are claiming to have killed around 200 Iraqis in the conflict, with around 100 killed on the Peshmerga side. It's still not clear exactly if the KRG will give in or if the Iraqi central government will move forward. We will be sure to update you on the situation as we get more informed on the developments. Now on to Iran. Yay! Iran is in Syria, or so we hear all the time. I think we need to better understand what Iran's involvement is, how they are accomplishing it, and what their motivation is. And that's what we're going to do today in this episode. Iran sees the survival of the Syrian government as being crucial. Syria provides a crossing point for Iran to supply Hezbollah in Lebanon. It provides a buffer state to Sunni domination in the region, as well as providing an important trading hub. Iran began supporting Syria in 2001. The IRGC began deploying technical aids as fears that the Syrian regime might fall in a manner similar to the governments in Tunisia and Egypt. Iranian senior foreign policy advisor Ali Akbar Vitali declared that Iran was not prepared to lose this golden counterweight to Israel. Here is a portion of an interview discussing Iran's motivations behind supporting Syria.
Talk a little bit about the Iranian interest in why they have decided for quite some time to stay entrenched in their support for Assad in Syria. But what really is in it for them?
Yes, this is a very great question. Actually, we have to refresh our memories when the Iran-Iraq war was going on, right after the revolution. And there were so many factors which made the Islamic Republic as we know it, established Islamic Republic. Taking the embassy, for instance, is one of them, which, of course, created the sanctions. And then, of course, the image of anti-imperialist of the regime as a populist element to be used to reestablish or establish the Islamic Republic, because the revolution was not about, Khomeini, for instance. It was a revolution. And there was a counter-revolution, in my judgment.
So this is the revolution in 1979, which was 79. A broad front of the Iranian people, which included Islamists, but also leftists, communists, exactly. Socialists, nationalists.
Exactly.
Except in the end, the Islamists win and actually kill off many of the leftists.
Exactly. And then the question was the deal, if you will, of Guadeloupe Conference between the people who really handled Khomeini, even though Khomeini was not preferred to the Shah, when the loss of the Shah, which was very unique, the very important son of Pax Americana, if you will, then there was no alternative. You know, the United States shifted to the other elements of the National Front, which, of course, they couldn't really handle that. Bakhtiar moved to really go with the Shah, as you remember, probably. And then the other side of the National Front moved to Khomeini. So there was division, total division between that. This is a secular movement division. And in that fundamental sense, the taking over of the embassy and then Iran-Iraq war established the counter-revolutionary forces of Khomeini. That was a so-called new revolution, if you will. So that's the regime. If you accept this premise, then Iran-Iraq war is extremely important. And Iran-Iraq war actually created a condition in the region that every Arab country, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, United Arab Emirates, all these sheikhdoms of the Persian Gulf went against Iran. And of course, Iraq was at the very head of it. And then the only regime which supported Iran was Bashar al-Assad of Syria.
Iran first started sending in riot control equipment and intelligence gear to help crack down on the protesters, as well as deploying some crack snipers. Turkey, in 2011, seized a truck full of goods traveling from Iran to Syria at a city of Kilis, saying that while the cargo was marked auto spare parts, it included weapons and riot gear. Also, in the case of a full-blown rebellion, Iran agreed to help develop a new military compound in Latakia Airport, which was completed the following year, just in case full-blown rebellion came out, so that way Iran would have a better launching ground to help the Syrian government. The man who negotiated that deal was Mohammed Kirbeck. Now remember that name, because he'll come in again later. The supreme leader of Iran, Ali Khamenei, confirmed the support for the regime, saying, quote, "In Syria, the hand of America and Israel is evident. Whenever a movement is Islamic, populist, and anti-American, we support it." In 2013, the Iranian government sent 4,000 troops to aid the Syrian government, mostly from the IRGC. The handling of the Syria crisis represented the first real example of Iran's foreign policy being outsourced to the IRGC, which regarded its involvement as a key test of its ability and, crucially, political unity. Emboldened by the presidential victory of Hassan Rouhani in 2013 and the opportunity to reboot Iran's international and regional relations, officials close to the president began to vocalize their concerns that direct engagement in Syria could prove negative to Iran's financial and ideological capital. However, this position faced strong opposition from the IRGC and the supreme leader, and soon subsided under the weight of the official narrative of resistance, according to which Syria constitutes the front line in the fight against terrorism and Tahrir-Kiri groups, which are Muslims who are considered unbelievers, like Daesh. Iran's Ministry of Foreign Affairs has sought to take back some control over the direction of the policy by kind of buying back into it, trying to turn a strategy which many officials considered misguided into some kind of multi-layered diplomatic initiative that could help the IRGC's agenda without blocking Iran into a war whose end even now is unforeseeable. The first stage in achieving this has been to emphasize the collective nature of the decision-making process. Even if the IRGC appears to have been led but being the lead decision-maker, the argument is that all elements of the entire Iranian security group have to help make those big decisions. The next stage has been to broaden the debate, framing the conflict in Syria as both part of a wider ideological struggle and a geopolitical struggle with Saudi Arabia, to overcome public disquiet at the cost of the intervention in Syria when the Iranian economy is still languishing. The Iranian leadership elevated its leading Quds Force commander, Qasem Soleimani, to the status of a celebrity, kind of trying to help keep the skeptics out of step with popular opinion. In 2014, this support continued, with specialists and intelligence soldiers along with regular deliveries of military supplies. Because if you remember, up until 2015, Iran was the sole international backer of Syria. It wasn't until 2015 when Russia intervened. By 2012, the Iranian mission had upgraded, and the deputy head of Iran's Quds Force was quoted saying that it had provided combat troops to make their way to Syria. Its allied force, Hezbollah, also began to operate in large numbers of forces in Syria, despite the protests of the other establishment parties in Syria. Here is a portion of an interview conducted discussing Hezbollah and their relationship to Syria.
In the Shia Muslim heartlands along Lebanon's eastern frontier with Syria, the Party of God is on the march. Here, yellow is the color of courage. Yellow is Hezbollah, a martyrdom project inspired by Iran's Ayatollahs. To the Western world, they are terrorists. They are the most potent political and military force in Lebanon. They're highly secretive, but have granted us unprecedented access. 26-year-old Abbas Farhad was cut down by machine gun fire inside Syria, fighting Sunni Muslim jihadis.
until recently, Hezbollah fighters were being martyred doing battle with Israel. That is why their movement was founded. These days, though, they are fighting and dying in Syria, waging somebody else's war.
In less than a year, Hezbollah has turned the tables for Syria's once beleaguered president, Bashar al-Assad, their Shia ally. Trained by Iran's revolutionary guards and armed by them too, Hezbollah have held their own against Israel. Now they have rallied to the cause of their patron, Iran, and ridden to al-Assad's rescue. Hezbollah's operations in Syria have been decisive. Entire rebel-held cities recaptured for Assad. Here, Hezbollah's TV station boasts of a spectacular ambush in which nearly 200 Islamist fighters were blown up. Then survivors raked by machine gun fire.
Since Hezbollah has been active in both on the ground training Syrian militias and fighting with their own combat troops. Despite their alliance with the Syrian government, the majority of Hezbollah's involvement is along the Lebanese border. Hezbollah's involvement in the war has not always been light. They have suffered over 1,000 casualties, and maintaining their support was difficult. It seems like they might not have stayed in the war as long if it wasn't for one man. Remember him? Mr. Kirbeck. Through the war and until he died in 2015, he coordinated Lebanese intervention in Syria. He pulled all of his ties with Iran and is seen as directly responsible for the involvement of Iran and Hezbollah in the Syrian fighters. Every year that support has continued. Estimates hold that there is at least 20,000 Iranian soldiers currently deployed in Syria. This involvement comes at a cost. Not only an economic cost, which is high, with billions of dollars in aid in the form of weapons, supplies, technology, and oil flooding into Syria, not only a military cost, which is at least 1,000 fighters, and many estimates place it much higher, but political capital cost. Since the beginning of the war, 3 high-ranking generals have been killed. Hussein Mohammadi, Major General, was killed in 2015, and then Mohsen Gharjan, Brigadier General, was killed in 2016, as well as another Brigadier General, Mohammed Pakle. What does all this look like from the Syrian side? Syria has not historically been the greatest ally of Iran. Before the 1970s, the leading Shia clerics of Iran and Iraq considered the Alawites of the Mediterranean coast to be heretics. However, when Iraq, under President Saddam Hussein, invaded Iran in 1980, Damascus was the only Arab capital that did not support Iraq, either militarily or ideologically. The Syrian Baathists had long since split from their Iraqi counterparts in Baghdad, and Damascus battled for the influence of the region, and the dream of Arab unity faded with the death of the Egyptian Nasser in 1970. Throughout the 8-year war, Iran, Iraq, Syria provided Iran with diplomatic support through Libya, Algeria, and Oman, all of which opposed Saddam in his conflict with Iran. It also allowed the Iranian Air Force to use Syrian airspace, logistics, and counterintelligence capabilities. Fundamentally, Iran and Syria have had an incredibly strong alliance that has gone on now for over 30 years, and doesn't look like it's going to change anytime soon. Iran is heavily invested in Syria and not likely to divest now. To help us further investigate this, we have an interview with Dr. Ghadarzi. So today, to help us unravel this, we have on the show Dr. Ghadarzi. Dr. Ghadarzi is an associate professor at Webster University in Geneva. He previously was a consultant on Middle Eastern affairs for the UN High Commission for Refugees. He has worked with a wide variety of research institutions, and his latest book is Syria and Iran, Diplomatic Alliances and Power Politics in the Middle East. Welcome, Dr. Ghadarzi, to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. So today, as mentioned before, we're kind of investigating Iran's relationship to Syria and the Iranian intervention. You've written extensively about this. Can you explain the kind of historical implications of the alliance?
Right. The alliance has been around for about 38 years. It came about after the Iranian Revolution, after the conservative pro-Western monarchy in Iran was overthrown and the revolutionary Islamist regime of Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini came to power. So after the overthrow of the Shah of Iran, the monarchy, you gradually had from February 79 onward, a thawing of relations between Syria and Iran. And the relationship then was cemented by the outbreak of the Iran-Iraq war in September of 1980 onward, when Saddam Hussein invaded Iran, who was a rival president, then President Hafez Assad, who is was the father of the current president of Syria. So the alliance has been around for 38 years, and it has been quite a strong, long-lasting, enduring alliance. And it cooperated in various spheres.
So we've seen this before. The current Syrian regime is Alawite, and we have the Shiite regime in Iran. Is there any kind of sort of religious component to these alliances? The Alawite tend to play up their relationship to Shiaism.
Yes, they do. But in terms of whether they're actually Shia Muslims or Muslims, many would say that's debatable. The alliance itself came about because of strategic reasons in terms of the mutual animosity with Saddam Hussein, also cooperating against Israel in the Eastern Mediterranean, against Levant and also in Lebanon. So I think the religious element historically for the most part has been overstated, in the sense that, just as I said, as your listeners may know, the majority brand of Islam is Sunni Islam. Shiites make up about 15% of the Islamic faith. The Alawites are considered an offshoot of Shia Islam at best. So, but the religious link is tenuous. But the thing to keep in mind, though, with regard to putting in context of the Syria crisis since 2011, is as the crisis continued and morphed into a regional proxy war involving Iran, Saudi Arabia, and all that, it has assumed a sectarian dimension, whereby Iran, Lebanese Hezbollah, which are Shiites, are helping the regime in Syria, while predominantly Sunni regimes such as Turkey, Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, and all that are helping the opposition. So it has assumed a sectarian dimension, but I would say at its roots, the alliance is not based on common religious ideology or identity of that, in that sense.
We actually, in a previous episode that we've recorded, we've actually explored the differences between the Alawites' faith and the Shiaism, and kind of questioned whether or not how strong that actual link is. Kind of related to this idea of this kind of strategic component of the alliance, both Iran and Syria felt threatened by the rise of Iraq, led by Saddam Hussein, and you yourself mentioned in your first answer the kind of ways that they kind of spurned this alliance structure. Did Syria feel threatened by Saddam Hussein, or did they kind of want to make more of an offensive alliance with Iran?
Yeah, well, there's an interesting history behind that, but in a nutshell, as you know, in 1978-79, you had the peace talks between Israel and Egypt, which were mediated by then U.S. President Jimmy Carter, which eventually led to the Camp David peace treaty in early 1979. So Egypt was taken out of the equation in the Arab world, and also especially vis-a-vis Israel. So what happened immediately after the Camp David Accords, Syria and Iraq engaged in extensive negotiations exploring the prospects of political unification. But these talks fell apart by 1980 in their recriminations, each side blaming the other. Hafez Assad of Syria blamed Saddam Hussein, while Saddam Hussein blamed the Syrians. So once the dialogue and negotiations broke down, and also with the Iran revolution having taken place, Syria basically drew closer to Iran, seeing Saddam Hussein as a rival, as an enemy. And then once Saddam Hussein invaded Iran, then you have the cementing, the consolidation gradually as the war dragged on for 8 years, the consolidation of the alliance between Syria and Iran. Many people oversimplified the alliance, arguing that it was simply an alliance of convenience, a marriage of convenience against Iraq. But that's definitely an important dimension of it, especially up until 2003. But then there are other considerations in terms of trying to check Israel, and also since both sides pursued fiercely independent foreign policies, and also were by and large, especially with regard to Iran, anti-Western, anti-American, and Syria to some degree, also in terms of trying to confront and contain Western, especially American influence in the region.
So we've seen mentioned before the deepening of the alliance has been occurring ever since the end of the Iran-Iraq War. How different is the relationship now than it was during the time of Hafez Assad? Has Bashar strengthened it? Has it changed at all?
The dynamics have changed. I mean, it evolved even during the time when the father of Bashar al-Assad, Hafez al-Assad, was in power. I would argue, and in my book, I argue that during the 1980s, the first decade of the alliance, Syria was the dominant actor in terms of Iran needed Syria more than Syria needed Iran in terms of having an Arab ally in the war, because Saddam Hussein tried to portray the war as an Arab-Persian, as an Arab-Iranian war, and the alliance with Syria helped Iran, which is a non-Arab country, predominantly Persian, try to dispel the Iraqi rhetoric that this was an Arab-Iranian, Arab-Persian confrontation. And also because of the fact that Syria at the time also had troops in Lebanon, it also had an alliance, a close relationship with the Soviet Union, while Iran, of course, did not have good relations. Iran had burned its bridges with the U.S. after the 79 hostage crisis, and its relations with the Soviet Union up until the collapse, the dissolution of the Soviet Union in 1991, were quite problematic. So Iran needed Syria more in the 1980s. The 1990s were a period of transition where Iran recovered after the war. It asserted itself. It began to also produce its weaponry, and gradually that was a period of transition. And I would argue by 2000 onward, which of course, as you know, in May of 2000, Hafez Assad died, his son came to power. From the beginning of the 21st century up until now, Iran has been the more dominant actor, and that has been accentuated then by the Syrian crisis. Once the crisis started and Iran started providing assistance to Syria and now has a large, a prominent presence and influence in Syria.
That actually rolls straight into my next question. So the Iranian government has come to the aid of Syria now, especially in this war we're seeing, you know, a significant presence of Iran inside of the country. How much do you believe that Syria relies on Iran for stability? Do you believe that it would still be winning the war without Iran's help?
Iran definitely, as you well know, the Syrian crisis, when it erupted in March 2011, started as peaceful protest demonstrations against the regime demanding political reform, freedom, liberalization. And of course, once the regime responded in a heavy-handed manner, it gradually transformed into an armed conflict. Iran, from the beginning, tried to help the Syrian regime contain the crisis in terms of initially trying to provide them assistance to contain and disperse the protesters, the demonstrations, quell the opposition. And then once you have the conflict transforming into an armed conflict, Iran then began providing greater assistance in terms of arms, oil, finance, and then sending initially military advisors. So between the eruption of the crisis in 2011 and September of 2015, when you had the Russian intervention, the Russia entering the conflict, Iran played a very important role in terms of helping the Syrian regime against the opposition. At the same time, I would argue that some of the claims of the Syrian opposition and what you read in the Western and mainstream Arab media about Iran's role have been overstated. So Iran has played a critical role, but one should put it in context. And of course, this has changed to some degree since September 2015, now that Russia is the primary foreign backer of the regime.
So we talked about now that Russia has kind of taken on the primary role of the supporting the regime. What role is Iran currently playing inside the country? Are they still mostly providing military advisors and aid? What is their primary role they're playing?
Well, in terms of goal, of course, from the outset, it has been trying to preserve the political status quo ante, to try to ensure the survival of the Assad regime, the Syrian Ba'athist regime. And as the crisis has evolved, they have basically augmented, ratcheted up their presence and their involvement in Syria. So initially it was advisors, then they spent specialist units, and then military units. And in terms of with the Russian intervention, of course, Russia is the dominant player. But overall, in terms of what we see on the ground, and especially when you look at what happened in the closing months of last year during the siege of Aleppo, by December, when Aleppo fell to the regime, pro-regime forces, by and large, there's been a division of labor between Russia and Iran, whereby Iran basically provides assistance to the Syrian ground forces and its own people, and also in terms of enlisting and mobilizing and helping Hezbollah, Shia Lebanese militia, Iraqi Shia militia, Pakistani Afghan militias also. So Iran's role is primarily in terms of trying to assist military operations on the ground, while the Russians, by and large, provide the air support for the regime forces.
with Lebanese Hezbollah movement helping inside of Syria, is their assistance inside of Syria primarily Iran's doing, or is that through their general alliance with the Syrian government?
I would say both. I mean, historically, the Hezbollah and Syria have enjoyed close relations. At times, relations have been problematic, especially at the outset when the movement emerged in the mid-80s. There are one or two crises, but they've been able to establish a close relationship. And also, in view of Iran's longstanding ties with Hezbollah in terms of funding it, helping it grow and flourish, both within the Lebanese and the regional context. So I would say it's for both reasons, for in terms of trying to further what it sees or preserve its own interests, but at the same time trying to align its position and policies with that of Iran.
So what are the costs of Iran's intervention? We've seen a mounting death toll as the war's gone on, both in also not just in manpower, though, but also the cost in resources, the cost in political power. What kind of costs are Iran taking in on this? And furthermore, do you believe that these costs are worth it for Iran?
Right. In terms of costs from the outset, when the Arab Spring erupted, as you know, first in Tunisia, then Egypt, then, of course, it spread to other countries, including Syria, the Iranian government tried to weave a very a convenient narrative that these opposition, these demonstrators, protesters were by and large Islamists who were demonstrating, protesting against oppressive, corrupt, pro-Western, pro-American regimes. So which was the case, of course, with regard to, for example, Tunisia and Egypt. But when the unrest started in Syria, this basically caught Iran off guard. And Iran then, somewhat reluctantly, but still because in view of its longstanding alliance, decided to throw in its lot and continue backing the regime rather than switch its support for the opposition. Iran, if you look at what transpired in the 5-6 years before the Arab Spring in terms of its stance during the 2006 Lebanon War, is the Israeli war against Hezbollah in Lebanon, and when Ahmadinejad was quite popular in the Arab Islamic street, but the Iran's involvement in Syria and assisting the regime to suppress the protesters and then the rebels has costed dearly in terms of its prestige and reputation in the Arab Islamic world, in the Middle East in general. So that's one element. The other element, of course, has been Iran over the past 6 years has poured in money, billions of dollars. We don't know the exact figures, but it's not insignificant. And also in terms of resources, manpower. So Iran has paid dearly. It has helped ensure the survival of the Assad regime. The Assad regime now controls only parts of Syria. It, of course, controls most of the main population centers in the west along the north-south axis. If you look at a map of Syria, the major population centers from south to north, Damascus, the capital, Hama, Homs, Aleppo, it controls those areas. But many other parts of the country, especially in the east, are not in its control. They're controlled by different rebel factions and all that. So in terms of restoring the pre-March 2011 political status quo ante, that's questionable. Iran, in terms of Iran and the Syrians, have been unable to do that, and it's doubtful in the sense that for the moment we're looking at the situation on the ground is resembles something like de facto partition of the country.
This is kind of to try not to wrap this all up then. So where do you believe the future of the Iranian-Syrian relationship is? Because you mentioned before, the Syrian government is kind of, again, at best, de facto partition with Idlib in the hands of the opposition, the north in the hands of the Kurds, and this kind of central region in the hands of the government. Do you believe that this alliance structure then will continue after the war is over? Where do you believe this relationship will continue?
Well, as long as the Assad regime is in power in Damascus and controls key areas in terms of the population centers I mentioned along the north-south axis in the western part of the country, key ports such as Latakia, Tartus, Banias, areas adjacent to Lebanon, so you can have the connection linked with Hezbollah and therefore Lebanon providing some strategic depth, Iran will continue to try to cultivate relations with Syria in terms of Syria being serving as a platform, as a springboard for it to project its power and influence in the Eastern Mediterranean, in Lebanon, and also in the Arab-Israeli area. At the same time, though, one must point out that what has happened over time is as the crisis has continued, has dragged on, and the Syrian state has become weaker and weaker and become hollowed out. Iran has augmented it. It's increased its presence on the ground in Syria. And this, to varying degrees, has also caused tensions between Iran and its Syrian allies, and also with the Russians. So there you have an interesting situation evolving. So one has to see. But to the extent possible, Iran is going to try to preserve, maintain the survival, ensure the survival of the Assad regime, and maintain its foothold and presence in and influence in that area.
Well, that's all we really had. Thank you so much for being on the show. Dr. Ghadarzi's book is Syria and Iran, Diplomatic Alliance and Power, Politics in the Middle East. You can get it where all good books are sold. I got mine on Amazon. Thank you, Dr. Ghadarzi.
My pleasure.
This has been the Syrian Civil War Podcast. Check us out at syriancivilwarpodcast.wordpress.com. And thank you to the amazing Noderberg and Myers for their introductory music and their transition music. Please check us out again, syriancivilwarpodcast.wordpress.com. Give us a rate, give us a review, and we'll see you next week for the Syrian Civil War Podcast.